Hi there, welcome to Victim to Victor, the podcast dedicated to empowering abuse survivors and inspiring healing, hope and positive change. I'm Anu Verma, a published author, and in every episode I'll sit down with a guest and embark on an insightful conversation about trauma as well as practical strategies to start the healing process. So let's get started. I hope you enjoy the show. And in today's episode, I have Candice Platter, who is an addictions therapist in private practice, where she specializes in working with the family and other loved ones of people who are struggling with addiction in her unique and signature family addiction counseling and therapy program. As a former opioid addict, being almost 35 years clean and sober, Candice has learned that overcoming addiction is a family condition. Everyone in the family is affected by addiction and everyone needs to heal. For more than three decades, she has helped both addicts and their loved ones understand their dysfunctional behaviours and make healthier life choices. And here is our wonderful Candice, all the way from Vancouver, Canada. How are you doing, Candice?
I'm doing great today. Yeah.
Thank you.
So hi,
much.
Everyone.
Yeah, so everyone, so Candice is here today and she is an addiction specialist, someone who has recovered from addiction, and today is her anniversary, 35 years.
35 wow. Years clean and sober, yeah, today.
That is amazing. What a day. Yeah. So today is actually the 18th of July. I know this episode won't be released on this date, but
that's okay.
It marks a significant time in your life, which you obviously it was a transition period. So you went from someone to someone who you are today. I mean, it'd be great for you to go more into your journey of, you know, what led you to addiction and, you know, what kind of place were you in back then?
Yeah, sure. I can do that. I guess I'd like to let people know that I'm an addictions therapist in Vancouver in private practice, but I work globally. We have clients all over the world. And if you're needing help, you can contact us as long as you can speak English, because right now we don't have any counselors who don't speak English. We hopefully will, but right now we don't. And we specialize in working with families and other loved ones of people who are struggling with addiction. So we work with the addicts, but only if we're also working with their families, because the families really need help. There's a lot of help out there for the addicts. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of help out there for you if you're a loved one. You know that. You know that there's not a lot of help out there for you. So that's what we provide. Yeah.
Okay. Is that why you talk about being the enabler and a helper?
Very much so. What we know today, I mean, there's a definite difference between enabling and helping. Enabling is when you do something for somebody else that they need to be doing and should be doing for themselves and can be doing for themselves. We need to let people do what they can and should and need to be doing for themselves and not be rescuing them. And helping is when you actually set some boundaries and you're coming at it from a healthier perspective. So we know that when an addict is of any kind, because we work with all kinds of different addiction, but you know, when an addict is being enabled, they don't recover. Not usually, because why should they, right? If somebody's going to take care of everything for them, why should they do any work on themselves?
Yeah.
And that's what recovery takes, is that inner work.
Yeah. Wow, yeah. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, to be a helper is somebody who, let's just say, you know, there's someone who is addicted to alcohol, which seems to be quite a prominent substance, which, you know, a lot of people are addicted to. And a lot of it, you know, it
it goes really blind-sided as well. People don't even realize, or you know, they don't own up to it because it's such a readily available substance. So to actually be a helper for someone who's an alcoholic would involve maybe, you know, leaving them, separating from them, so that they can go and help themselves.
Yeah, there are a lot of different things that can be done before somebody leaves a relationship. Before, like that's kind of the last resort in a way. Yeah. So there are many things that can be done before that, but that may be what, and often is what people get to. They say they finally say to their alcoholics or their addicts, you know, I don't want to live this way anymore. And if you're not willing to change, then I'm not willing to be here. It's really, you know, the main message of all of this is for the loved one to be able to say to the addict, I love you so much. I love you. Mm. And because I love you, I don't want to see you in addiction. I don't want this life for you. So I am not willing, or we as a family are not willing to support you if you choose to stay in active addiction. We're not going to be supporting you because we don't want this for you. It's because we love you. It's not a punishment, but we don't want to help you thrive in, won't be thriving, but we don't want you to stay in addiction. So we won't support addiction, but we will support recovery. So when you're ready to move into recovery, you let us know and we'll be there for you in all the ways we can be.
So let's talk about you and your journey.
Me, yes.
So what age were you when you realized that you were addicted?
Well, it all started before that. I was in my early 20s and I suddenly got very sick one day. I went out for lunch with a friend and things were never the same. We thought I had food poisoning. That's what the symptoms were, you know, and that I would be better soon, but I didn't get better. I didn't get better for a very long time. And I was finally diagnosed with Crohn's disease, which is an inflammatory bowel disease with, you know, all kinds of difficult symptoms like diarrhea and nausea and things that people don't want to talk about, you know, so that everybody thinks is so shameful when it happens to all of us anyway. But it's a very painful, debilitating, horrible, shameful disease, you know, and I was quite young then, and I didn't know how to handle it. The doctors didn't know what to do for me. It was just misery. And so what the doctors did, because Crohn's was a pretty new disease at that point, and they just didn't know what to do. So they gave me a lot of very addictive medications. They prescribed prescription after prescription after prescription of Valium and codeine and OxyContin and morphine and Demerol and all of these, really, you know, anybody's body would get addicted to them, and mine definitely did. But they helped, you know, and I also smoked a lot more pot than I had ever smoked before. I smoked socially when I was at university, but I, you know, it, again, it helped. It relieved a lot of the symptoms and helped with the shame and the loneliness. And my life just got very small. So for the next 15 years or so, I had become an opioid addict. And I had no idea of that. I didn't know that. I was just taking these medications. But these medications, all of these substances, are depressants in the human body. Pot is as well. Alcohol is as well. And I was using that sometimes too. So by the end of those years, I had become so depressed that I was actually suicidal. And I really thought that I might kill myself. You know, I had enough pills. I could time it so that nobody would find me. And I kind of got scared because I really was thinking about this. And so what I did was I reached out for help. I called the Vancouver Crisis Center. Most cities have a crisis center now. Mm-hmm. And I can't even remember if it was a man or a woman, but whoever it was, they kind of saved my life because they were very respectful with me and really heard my pain and suggested to me some things that I could do. And as that process happened, one of the things that was suggested strongly by a psychiatrist was that I sign myself into one of the psychiatric wards here in Vancouver. So I voluntarily signed myself into a psych ward. It was like, take my clothes, because if you don't do that, I don't know what will happen if I'm out in the world. I don't know what I'll do to myself. Yeah, so I was in the psych ward for about 4 weeks or so, and I started getting the counseling I needed, and I, from some other people I met there, I heard about Narcotics Anonymous 12-step program, started going to that. And you know, it was the beginning of my recovery. So that's why I'm still here. That's why I'm still here today.
Yeah. I suppose when you did actually go and see your psychiatrist, did you uncover a lot of deep-rooted issues which might have led you to actually take the substances?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, the substances were all prescribed except for the pot, of course, but it was all prescribed. And so being the good girl, you know, that I was, I followed the doctor's orders. And it felt better to do that. But, you know, in the years since then, a big part of my journey has been learning how to actually deal with having Crohn's disease, because it's one of those incurable illnesses. I still have it. But it's so much better now because I look after myself. I eat right, and I deal with my stress, and I've healed a lot of childhood stuff. I've healed a lot of the trauma that I was carrying around with me. So it's a much easier life now, but it's hard work to be in recovery. It's hard work to get through this, but I think it's harder to stay in it and not do the work it takes to come out of it.
It is harder. Absolutely. I can see that, because like you said, I like what you said, that you know, your world, it shrinks, doesn't it, when you are an addict, whereas now you're obviously free and you're living abundantly and limitless opportunities, and it's just a totally different way of life.
That's right. And you know, somebody asked me the other day how I was going to celebrate being 35 years clean and sober. What are you going to do? How are you going to celebrate? I said, I think I'll just go to the bar and knock back a few, you know. But of course I was joking, and I'm not going to be doing that. But you know, it's such a better life for me and everybody I know who doesn't use substances like that. It's such a better life. It's so worth whatever it is that it takes to get you here. And you know, if I can do this, because my life was not a picnic. It wasn't a picnic before all those prescriptions. It wasn't a picnic during those, you know, it has not been an easy life for me. And it's a lot easier now. If I could get through this, if I can go into recovery and have 35 years clean and sober, it's kind of like anybody can. It's a choice. Underneath everything else, it's a choice about whether we stay in active addiction or go into some kind of recovery. And everybody who's in recovery knows that. We all know that. It's a choice.
They do. Yeah. And so, you know, it'd be interesting to kind of go more into, you know, the kind of addiction therapy, you know, that you offer and the services that you offer, and you know, what it is that actually drives people to succeed and those to actually drop out. But I just wanted to ask as well, because with yours, obviously, it was opioids, which, you know, which are painkillers. So this is quite common amongst other people with many different illnesses. There's, you know, there's so many prescription drugs out at the moment, and it's just normal to get addicted to them without even realizing it.
Well, they're supposed to, they're made to be addictive. These substances are created to be addictive. Mm. And there's a lot of people making a lot of money off of these substances. And so those people want to keep people addicted. And, you know, they attach to the receptor sites that we have in our brains and our and the rest of our bodies, and they just wreak havoc. And the doctors, you know, when they were giving me those medications, it was such a long time ago, and addiction was not on the radar. So in their defense, I don't think they had any idea of what they were doing to me, what was going to happen to me. I don't think that they just wanted to help this young woman who was in so much pain and so depressed, you know. But today, doctors know about addiction. They know. There's no question about that. And they're still prescribing these things instead of trying to help their patients learn how to handle pain in a different way. Because it's not just illness. It's also things like accidents that leave people in pain, you know, in chronic pain. Absolutely. There are ways to deal with chronic pain. And I've had to learn that so that I didn't have to use these mind-altering substances.
God, I remember when I had an accident, and the doctor had me on them, and wow, it was just a totally different feeling.
I know. I know.
I felt guilty. I was like, oh my God, I feel guilty if you're feeling so amazing.
I feel terrific. You know, let's have more of this.
This isn't right.
You know, when I was about 8 months clean, I really wanted to take a one-year cake, which is how you celebrate time in 12-step programs. I really wanted to have an actual cake and people say nice things about you. And it's like that. It's like having an obituary, like having a memorial for yourself while you're still alive. It's kind of like that. And I really wanted to take a one-year cake. And but my Crohn's was so bad at that point that I had to have major surgery, like major slice and dice kind of surgery, and have them take parts of my bowel out. And I had told the nurses and the doctors that I was an addict, so that we could manage the painkillers and do that. And I think they had it in their charts, but when I woke up from the surgery back in my room, I was attached to a machine that was giving me morphine that I could control with my thumb.
Wow.
So I could give myself as much morphine as I wanted to.
Oh my goodness. That is a recipe for disaster.
Well, it really could have been. And I know for a lot of people it would have been. For me, you know, my bottom, being in a psych ward, being suicidal, I never want to go back to that place. I never, ever want to. So this is a big part of what keeps me clean and sober every day. There's other things too, because I love the life I have now. I like myself now. I have my self-respect now.
Yeah.
But I really don't want to have to go back into any kind of institution like that, you know. And so when I was lying in this bed in the hospital, I knew that I had to make a choice. I knew that was what it was going to take. So what I decided was that I was going to use the morphine for 2 days.
Okay.
Just for 2 days. And then I told the nurses to get that machine out of my room and to not bring it back.
Wow.
And so I started taking extra strength Tylenol, you know, medications like that. And they brought ice packs for me. Okay. They just kept bringing ice packs to numb the area that was so painful. And, you know, after a few days, the pain started to subside. I was lying in that bed, just kind of moaning and weeping, and, you know, but I knew it would get better. It had to get better, you know? Yeah. So I just waited it out and did what I could, did my part. And yeah, it got better. Wow. Right. And wow. I took my 1 year cake. My 1 year cake.
what type of cake was it?
And it was probably chocolate, because that, yeah. why eat cake if it's not chocolate?
Exactly, you know? Right. Doesn't make sense. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay. Wow. Yeah. I love that. And so, wow. Okay. I mean, have you had any blips, you know, any
occurrences? Any relapses? No, I haven't. But I will say that there have been times with my Crohn's that I've needed to be on a little painkiller for a little length of time. Okay. And when, because, you know, there's a line between use and abuse of these medications. And when you need them, it's like, thank God they're there. But to keep on them, to stay on them, will only hurt you. It will not help. It will only hurt you. So when I have to have something like this, which is not very often anymore, I would just let somebody know. I'd let a friend know, or a sponsor if I had a sponsor at that point, or I just made sure that I was being accountable with it. Mm. So that, because one of the things with addicts who are relapsing, they think to themselves, well, you know, I can have a little bit. Nobody will know. Nobody will know. I'll just keep it secret. Mm-hmm. But the most important person on the planet knows.
Yeah.
And so exactly. We need, and those secrets keep us sick. So
yes.
My suggestion for anybody who, you know, has a problem with addiction and needs to take painkillers sometimes mm-hmm. is to make sure that you're being honest and upfront about it. And so I never had to actually relapse with it. And good. I'm very grateful for that.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, that is so, so true. Because, openness and honesty win all the time. And so, you know, whenever I see people around me who, you know, they might have addiction issues, you know, it might not even be drugs, it might be alcohol, it might just be
Alcohol's a drug, though. Alcohol is a drug. It's just a liquid drug. It's a mind alterer. But something like sex addiction is a mood alterer. It doesn't actually affect your brain that much, not like these substances do, but it's used for the same purpose.
Right, okay. Yeah. And then there's addiction to food.
Yep.
Mm.
Yeah. I have trouble with chocolate. I have to be careful with chocolate, you know. I could do worse, and I have done worse, so it's okay. But yeah, when you have like a sex addiction or a shopping addiction, you know, something like that, or gambling, it's there's an excitement that people are addicted to. And, you know, sex addiction isn't about sex.
No.
Overspending isn't really about spending.
No.
It's really the addiction itself is not the actual issue when you're working with it, when you're a therapist working with it.
Yeah.
It's not the issue. The issue is what's underneath. What are the feelings or the trauma or what it is what is it that you're trying to kind of squash down and not have to feel? Yeah, to suppress. And once we heal that, once we get that out into the light and we heal that, you don't need addiction anymore.
Yeah.
People use addiction to try to feel better about themselves, about their lives. The problem with it, I mean, I like it that people want to feel better. I love that people want to feel better. But the problem with using addiction for that is that it only feels good for about a minute and a half, maybe. And then it bites you on the butt. Then it bites you.
It does.
Then it ruins your life. Yeah.
It's awful. It is. Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, you hit the nail on the head before when you mentioned about shame. Shame, guilt. It's been a very big part of my own trauma journey. And so I just feel like it's all shame, guilt, you know, it's...
Yeah, shame and guilt. And I can speak to that if you'd like. Yeah. I can say a few things about that. You know, a lot of the shame that people feel, a lot of people have been hurt and abused and traumatized, and especially in childhood, and they bring that into adulthood. And that some of that stuff happened to me as well, lots of trauma in my past. And like all other children who will go through this, I believed that somehow it was about me, because children don't know how to explain to themselves why they're being hurt over and over again. They don't know how to explain that. They just don't. Mm-hmm. And so the only way they can think of to explain it is it must be me. It must, you know, mm-hmm. if I was smarter or prettier or better at sports, or if I was thiser or thatter, then they would love me and they wouldn't hurt me. That's how a child tries to figure it out. But yeah. It isn't about them. It isn't about the person that's being abused. It's about the person who is abusing and what their need is to abuse somebody else. That's what it's really about. So when people start to understand that, especially as adults, when we start to understand that this was never about me, this was about somebody's need to hurt me.
Yeah.
You know, life gets much better when we understand that.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. And yeah. Because, you know, when we're young, we're so powerless that, you know, we just give our control away to people, especially when they're older than us, or, you know, more authoritarian than us.
And that's so, right. And and we're brought up to believe that that's what we're supposed to do as children.
Exactly.
We're supposed to honor our parents and our grown-ups and our, you know. Yeah. And then when we become adults, if we've been in that situation, we sometimes have the tendency to let other people continue to abuse us until we heal that within ourselves. We allow other people to do that. That's when it becomes about us. Because if we're going to let that happen, we teach other people how to treat us. And if we're going to let somebody else do that to us, that's about us. We need to do something about that. We need to reach out for help around why we're doing that and stop that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But the rest of it wasn't about us. And we need to stop carrying that shame. It's the abuser's shame. It's not our shame.
It's not ours. Exactly. Oh, wow. I love that. What a fantastic insight. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. And then there's this thing with guilt. You know, like people think that guilt, I've heard it said that guilt is this useless kind of emotion, and it doesn't help at all to feel guilty, so don't feel guilty.
Yeah.
But guilt actually serves a purpose, I think.
Okay.
When, you know, if I were to say something to you that was rude or inappropriate or untoward, and I felt bad about that inside, I felt guilty about that, that's terrific. That's really good information for me, because then I can go to you and I can say, that wasn't my intention. I'm so sorry if I hurt you. I didn't mean to. And it would be the guilt that I was feeling that would get me there. Other than that, guilt does not serve any purpose.
No,
I don't think. It's pretty useless other than that.
It is. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Just the word. Oh God. It's like the amount of times that, you know, we say, oh, I feel so guilty for letting her down. Oh, I feel so guilty. It's like, come on. Don't feel guilty.
Yeah. And the thing is that you have a life too. And if you need to not do something that you'd plan to do because something happened, well, that's okay. You can make an amend. You can, you can reestablish whatever it was that you were going to do. There are ways to work around it where you don't have to feel ashamed of yourself, and you don't have to feel, you don't have to carry around a lot of guilt, because why would you want to do that?
I know. Absolutely. Wow. So let's go on to your practice. Wow. So how long have you been helping people?
I was helping people, I think, before I cleaned up. I was a teacher, a school teacher for a while, for about 10 years. And I worked with youth as well as a counselor, but, you know, I was working with them and then going home and getting high.
Oh.
So, you know, okay. Not a good plan.
No.
But once I started my recovery from addiction, I knew I wanted to work in the addiction field because I had received so much help. Now I wanted to be able to give back. So I started really learning about addiction and forming my own understanding of it. And so when I was about 3 years clean, I got a job and started working as an addiction counselor in an area of Vancouver called the Downtown East Side,
okay,
which is the lowest income area in Canada.
Okay.
It's where most of the addicts and alcoholics and homeless and people with mental health issues congregate and live on the street, and it's that kind of place. So I worked down there as a counselor for 16 years, and man, I got an education that I could never have gotten anywhere else, you know.
Yeah.
And what I found out as I was working with the addicts and the alcoholics down there was that there was a really big and amazing gap in services, because the families were calling me. The families of the addicts that I was seeing started to call me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying, we're just at the end of our rope. We don't know what to do. We love them so much, but they're not getting any better and we don't know what to do. And so I started to work with them without having any idea how to work with them. But because there's no courses, or there weren't back then, there was nobody was doing that work. And the families were suffering so much. So so as I started to work with them, I saw patterns in every family that were basically the same. And it all boiled down to the difference between enabling and helping. These families were giving their addicts money. They were driving their addicts to the dealer or the liquor store.
My.
They were letting them live at home, rent-free, use all day, use all night, sleep all day, things that just aren't okay and won't get the addict out of addiction, will keep the addict stuck in addiction. That's what that does.
So why were they doing that? Is it just out of love, trying to support them?
It was out of love, and it was out of, we don't know what else to do.
Right.
We don't know what to do.
Okay.
So when I saw all of these patterns, I started teaching them about, about setting some boundaries, about, and then I named my company Love with Boundaries, because if we're not loving addicts and having boundaries and self-respect, they are not going to change at all. Because there's no incentive. Why should they? So then I decided to write a book, because I knew that I couldn't work with all the families that I wanted to work with. I thought, if I write a book, I'll put it down on paper.
Yeah.
People can read about it. And much to my surprise, it won USA and international book awards.
Wow.
I didn't expect that. I was an addict. I didn't expect to ever be able to do anything that was going to help anyone, But that's what happened. And this is my
amazing
book.
Oh, I love
it's
that.
It's called Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself.
Oh,
this
wow.
is the loved one and this is the addict.
Okay. Right? I love
so
that.
It's the top 10 survival tips for loving someone with an addiction.
Beautiful.
And it's written specifically for the loved ones. It's not written for the addicts. Do not give my book to your addict, because he will hate it. They will hate it.
Ooh, okay.
Because I'm talking about boundaries and consequences. Yeah. They don't want that. Little by little, I just became known for doing this work. And there aren't that many other people who are doing this work with families. So,
you were first.
Yeah, I think I was one of the first for sure.
Wow. Yeah. I just think that's amazing. And again, when you think about the addict, it is about the addict. You don't even think about the support network around them and how important it is to support them.
To support the family. That's right. Yeah. That's right. And you see, the addict isn't going to come to the family and say, please, please set some healthy boundaries for me. And thank you for doing it. Please and thank you. No. They're never going to, they're not, maybe someday when they're years into their recovery, they might come to you and say, thanks, mom and dad, you know, but other than that, they're not going to do that. So if you want your addict to change, and most families do, you have to change first. You have to change what you're doing that's problematic. You have to make it so that your addict isn't comfortable staying in addiction.
Yes, exactly.
You have to do what's right for the addict even when it's not comfortable for you. And that's what the, that's what our counseling is about. And so the people, the families who get this, who really understand this and do this work, the dynamics in the family change so much. It's just astounding.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
God. Give us some examples.
Oh, okay. Wow. That's okay. So there was a family that I was working with who had have a daughter. They have two children, two adult children. The son is doing very well in his life. But the daughter, I think she had some trauma in her life that wasn't talked about. I think she may have been raped or something happened to her. Very intelligent, beautiful, you know, young woman who made the decision to live in the downtown East Side, that place that I was talking about. She was using heroin, and she was living with a man who was not treating her well, who had a police record, that kind of thing. And she was allowing herself to be mistreated. Her parents, wonderful people, wonderful family. It happens in all kinds of families. Like, it's not about, it's not about being a bad parent and that's why my child is using. In most cases, it's not about that at all. So they, the daughter would call the parents at like 10 o'clock at night and say, I need shampoo. And they would get up. If they were in bed, they'd get up, they'd get dressed, they'd get in their car, they'd drive down, you know, quite a ways from where they lived to see her and bring her shampoo. And do those kinds of things. And then they'd come home and they'd undress, they'd go to bed, they'd get up for work in the morning.
I mean, that sounds quite nice, but it's not.
It's nice for her, in a way. It's nice for her. She gets what she wants. These parents were kind of going crazy. So when they came to see me, we stopped that. We had a boundary that you can call us until about 9 o'clock at night, and then we're turning the phone off. It took a little while for them to get to these boundaries, but we're turning the phone off. And if you need something, you can leave a message and we'll get back to you in the morning. And you know, and this is how they, and now these parents, she's much better. And the parents are, you know, they go on cruises and trips, they play golf, they have a life of their own now.
Yeah.
That's what has to happen is, you know, so they're not always thinking about their addict and chasing after their addict and doing everything for their addict. And that's no way to live, and it doesn't help the addict. It's not a loving act toward the addict. It just kind of feels like maybe it is, but it isn't really.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, whenever I hear about any addiction stories, it always just involves the addict person having to go and segregate themselves, you know, whether that's by choice or, you know, the fact that everyone's left them. But that's the only way, it seems, for them to heal.
Well, it's one of the ways that they, you know, I believe that people need to reach some kind of a bottom.
Yeah.
We call it a bottom. Mine was quite low, being in a psych ward and going through all that. But it doesn't have to be that low. The parents need to be able to say to their adult children or to their spouse or children need to say this to parents sometimes when the parents are the ones that are addicted, to say to them, look, we love you so much. Yeah. We love you so much, but we're not going to support your addiction anymore. We're not going to see you if you're in addiction. We're not going to, you know, give you money so that you can stay in addiction. We're not going to support your addiction, but we will support your recovery. So yeah. Let us know when you're ready for that. That's what changes everything. That's what changes it.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And if people want to hear more about this, I have a TED talk, a TEDx talk. You can just look me up and look up TEDx. And you'll. I think it's called How to Love with Boundaries, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I shall be putting the links in this description.
Okay.
So absolutely. Great. And also your book. So where can they find your book?
My book is on Amazon. I also have a workbook that also won some awards.
Oh, amazing.
This is the workbook that goes with it.
I absolutely love the butterfly. So
I know.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
The butterfly?
Yeah.
Well, if you want to know the story of the butterfly, I can tell you.
Yeah.
A butterfly starts out as a caterpillar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a caterpillar doesn't get any respect at all. A caterpillar is squished by little boys. Mm-hmm. Little girls like to shriek, oh, it's a caterpillar. And biology teachers dissect them in class. And caterpillars just have a really hard time. I was a caterpillar for a long time.
Okay.
And then a caterpillar has an instinct. It knows that if it doesn't change, mm-hmm. it's going to die.
Yes.
So it shimmies up a tree trunk and shimmies down a limb and it hangs upside down and it creates a cocoon of bug juice, I like to call it. And it sits in this bug juice for as long as it takes to change almost entirely its DNA.
Wow. Okay.
And it grows wings. And when it's as soon as it's ready, like not a moment before, it emerges into this beautiful creature that nobody shrieks at and people don't try to kill, you know. Yeah. But if you look at this butterfly here, like that's the caterpillar part.
That is, yeah.
And all the rest of it is new. All the rest of it is changed. Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So today... I am a butterfly most days. Yeah. I have my moments, but most days I'm a butterfly and we all have that butterfly potential in us.
We do.
It just takes a little work. Got to sit in some bug juice for a while.
I love that. And the colors as well, gold and black, powerful colors. So, oh wow. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. And so So that's what I was going to ask, you know, as well, you know, people want to contact you and get hold of you.
And excuse my voice. I'm, you know, going a little hoarse right now. If people want to contact, if you want to work with us, if you're having a problem, if you love somebody with an addiction and you're not quite sure how to handle that, please reach out. You can read my book. I have videos, a lot of videos on YouTube. If you want to work with us, if you go to my website, which is lovewithboundaries.com, which I think you'll have on your show notes, there's a link for a questionnaire. It's a short one. If you fill out the questionnaire, as soon as we get it, we'll get back to you to schedule a free 30-minute consultation. By Zoom or by phone, and there's no strings attached at all. No. You can tell us about what's happening for you. We'll tell you what we do. If it's a fit, we go forward. If it isn't, that's fine. You know. So, if you need help, we hope that you will reach out and let us know that, and we'll do everything we can for you to help you figure this out. Because we can kick addiction to the curb. I mean, we really can.
You really can.
But it takes doing some things differently.
Absolutely, yeah. And it all starts from within.
It really does. It really does. Yep.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, wow. Thank you so much. What an amazing insight into, you know, addiction and just looking at it from a different angle, because normally, you know, it's, we're looking at it from the point of view where we're trying to help the addict, but I just love this. Yeah.
And we're also looking at it, the 12-step model looks at it as, you know, a brain disease, and we're powerless over it, and we'll relapse, and that's just going to be how it is. And I just, you know, I'm 35 years clean and sober, and I've never relapsed. So I don't, and I have a disease. Crohn's disease is very different from addiction. I cannot just get rid of Crohn's, and I've certainly tried, but I can get rid of addiction. It's a choice. Underneath whatever else it is, it's a choice about whether we stay in addiction or we go into recovery.
Right. Yes. That's it. It is a choice. And
it's a choice.
Yeah. That's all it takes. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so the families also need to make the choice to do what's right, to be able to help their addicts and stop enabling them. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So be a helper, not an enabler.
Yes, exactly.
That's beautiful. Wow. Thank you so much, Candice. It's been an absolute honor having you on. And congratulations again for your book and your workbook. Amazing achievements. Yeah. Really amazing. And so everyone, please do go and connect with Candice. Social media as well, are you on?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, all of it. You know, you can find me on all of it. Yeah.
Brilliant. And again, I'll be adding all the links. But that's all we've got time for, my friends. I hope you did enjoy this episode. And again, Candice, you've been amazing. And please do get in touch if you have any questions about this episode or any questions about anything. I'm sure Candice will be honoured to hear from you all.
I would love it.
That's all we've got time for today, my dear friends. And we look forward to seeing you on the next show. All the best and take care.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Victim to Victor. Subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes, and be sure to follow the podcast on socials to keep updated on what's next, and share Victim to Victor with family and friends to help grow the community and spread the positive healing energy.